Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Difference a headline makes. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And heading out this afternoon, in fact, when we get off the air to Madison, Wisconsin. I'm looking forward to this, the Nonstop Radio Symposium in the Exhibition Hall. You can check it out at nonstopradio.com, and we'll be doing our show tomorrow from our affiliate in Madison, the Mike 92.1. Anyhow, what a difference a headline makes. You look, this is the ultimate statement for why we need a simple, straightforward, here's the news, here's your summary website out there. Recently on Chris Matthews' Hardball Show, he had a couple of reporters on, and one was from the Washington Post, one was from the New York Times. This was like maybe a month ago. Frankly, I don't remember the names of the people, but it doesn't matter, you know, for the purposes of the story. And he just in passing, you know, they were all talking about some story that was a big story, and he just in passing said words to the effect of, how many of you guys, to what extent do you guys figure that the Drudge Report is the assignment editor for the American media? To what extent do you think the Drudge Report is the assignment editor for the American media? In other words, they set the tone. They define the stories that everybody else is going to cover. And everybody agreed that in every newsroom in America, from small local newspapers and radio stations and television stations to the New York Times and the Washington Post, they check the Drudge Report a couple times a day. Well, you check the Drudge Report right now, and the headline in the top says, up! Economy grew at 1.9% pace in second quarter. Recession on hold. In all caps. Sounds great! Sounds great! But then you go to the Financial Times, right? This is the world's largest business newspaper. It actually has a larger circulation in the United States than it does in the UK. The Financial Times of London, independent of Rupert Murdoch, independent of the right wing. It's just about the rich talking to the rich and nothing else. And the headline on the front page of the Financial Times, weak U.S. growth adds to gloom. The U.S. economy, and they say the exact same thing the Drudge Report said, where the Drudge Report said recession on hold. They say the U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 1.9% in the second quarter, a faster pace than earlier in the year, but slower than economists were expecting. And what are the subheads? In-depth U.S. downturn, U.S. home prices plunged by 15.8%, and record deficit of $482 billion forecast for 2009. So the rest of the world's looking at our economy going, oh, we got problems. Matt Drudge is looking at our economy saying, ain't everything wonderful? Congressman Dennis Kucinich is on the line with us. I wanted to be sure to get to this topic, this story. Congressman, welcome to the show.
Tom, thank you very much for the opportunity to be on your show.
How are we doing with this whole range of stuff that you've been very involved with, from the contempt citations? I know you're not on the committee that is doing it,
out in favor of doing that.
So where are we at on this and on Karl Rove and the impeachment of George W. Bush? Nancy Pelosi saying on The View yesterday or the day before yesterday, well, I don't know that he's committed any crimes. I mean, what's going on?
Well, first of all, I want your listeners to know that within the next few hours, I will be submitting a petition to Nancy Pelosi in the House of Representatives with the signatures by email of over 100,000 people who have called for impeachment. Most of these have come out in the last few days. Now, if any of your listeners want to be included in that, They still have a couple hours to do so because we had a deadline extended slightly. And if they go to Kucinich.us to the impeachment petition, you can sign in and push us over 100,000. And in the meantime, the speaker was on The View yesterday, and it was called to my attention that she had said that she didn't see any evidence of crimes that had been committed. I am more than happy to call to her attention the details of the 35 articles of impeachment that I submitted, plus the other article relating to the war, plus the articles relating to Mr. Cheney, because individually and in total, they categorically state laws that have been broken. And it may be that in her capacity as speaker, where she's no doubt has the busiest job in the Congress, that she hasn't read those articles. But if she does, I think she will see that there is a case for the judiciary to proceed, which is one of the reasons why last Friday was so important. 6 hours of hearings, over a dozen witnesses, 24 members of Congress attended this hearing. For the first time, we were able to break the silence and begin the discussion about the violations of law that have been committed by George Bush and other members of his administration.
Right, and you, our listeners, can get over to Kucinich.us and sign the petition that Congressman Kucinich in the next few hours is going to be presenting to Speaker Pelosi. And, of course, you can also go to callcongress.org and get the toll-free numbers for Capitol Hill, and you can call Speaker Pelosi's office and let your thoughts be known. And call your local member of the House of Representatives and say, will you please support Congressman Kucinich in this? How does that sound as a beginning?
I mean, that's great, and I just want to stress that we had a deadline of midnight on the petitions. I was told that I could submit them to the Congress by the end of business day, and they are addressed directly to the Speaker. So what I just want to let everyone know who's listening to Tom Hartman's show right now, you still have a chance to be registered in support of the impeachment petition. Go to Kucinich.us, and thank you for giving me the chance to mention that.
Now, you're also, Congressman, supporting or sponsoring, I don't have all the details on this, legislation that has to do with the Iraq oil, basically the no oil for war. You have the phrase for it.
Here's what's going on. Everyone who's been following the situation with the war in Iraq understands the connection between the war in Iraq and oil. And I was the first one to bring it up in a debate with Richard Pearl on Meet the Press back in February of 2003. And now Mr. Pearl, according to the Wall Street Journal, is involved in seeking to do business in Kurdistan relating to oil. My legislation, which I'm submitting to Congress today, will bar any U.S. oil companies from either investing in or having any kind of activity that deals with the petroleum resources of Iraq, and thereby, Tom, stopping them from benefiting from the war. We know that Vice President Cheney and the oil company executives met prior to the war. We know there were maps of Iraq oil fields spread out on the table. We know that both Mr. Greenspan and Henry Kissinger noted the significance of oil in terms of this war. We know that the price of oil was about $30 a barrel, roughly, in 2003, prior to the invasion, and today it's over $122 a barrel. A gallon of gas was about $1.77 then. Today it's about $3.97 on the average. The gas didn't go down for the American consumers, but the profit sure went up for the oil companies.
Right.
And so I'm saying, stop them from being able to do business in Iraq, and stop the privatization of the Iraq oil company, because that's really what this ends up being. There's an attempt to create three petrostates by partitioning Iraq and by letting these oil companies essentially run those areas as in the matter of what I call oligarchs. So we need a whole new approach, and it begins with this bill that stops the U.S. oil companies from being able to have any dealings at all in Iraq.
This is the Oil for Iraq Liberation Act, and you can read about that also over at Kucinich.us. It reminds me, Congressman, of what has happened in Nigeria. It reminds me of how we were talking on the program yesterday about how the current president of Mexico is now talking about privatizing the oil in Mexico, even though their constitution forbids it. This transnational petro, these oil companies are they're larger than most countries.
You're right about that, and you know, consider this. Now, Chalmers Johnson, in his book called Nemesis, which I would recommend to your listeners, mm-hmm. writes about the United States having 737 bases in 130 countries. So what you do is you've got a government that uses military power to help out corporate interests, and the corporate interests capitalizing from U.S. Military and foreign policy. We've got to change the direction of this country. We have to start reminding ourselves what the mission of America was. It wasn't for empire. It was to be able to have a republic which met the needs of its people, and we aren't doing that anymore. Yeah. And so that's why, in a small way, this bill helps to flag the direction that we've gone wrong, and hopefully with the members of Congress who have already indicated to me they support it, including Mr. Conyers, that we'll have a chance to have some hearings on this and take us in a new direction.
That's great. This and Peter DeFazio's Use It or Lose It on the oil leases.
Good man.
You know, yeah, a lot of great stuff out there. Congressman Dennis Kucinich, Kucinich.us. Get over there, sign the petition, and call your member of Congress. Call Speaker Pelosi's office. Congressman Kucinich, once again, thank you for the great work you're doing.
Tom Hartman, thank you.
And hopefully our 4 million listeners will have something to say to their members of Congress. Good talking. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Hey, who do you think, just in passing here, who do you think Barack Obama is going to choose as his running mate? Here are some options. Evan Bayh, Joe Biden, Wes Clark, Hillary Clinton, Chris Dodd, John Edwards, Chuck Hagel, Tim Kaine, Janet Napolitano, Sam Nunn, Jack Reed, N. Rendell, Bill Richardson, Kathleen Sebelius. I mean, who is it going to be? There's a poll over at airamerica.com if you'd like to weigh in on that. You can just go to airamerica.com, and it's right there. There's an Uncle Sam logo or picture that you can click on, and it'll get you right to it. The economy. I wanted to get back to this just to wrap this thing up that I started. And by the way, actually before I do that, Dennis Kucinich, we really need to be supporting this effort, even though the Democratic Party as a whole, certainly the leadership of the Democratic Party, and I've talked to a couple of members of Congress, Democratic members of Congress, who do not want to be quoted by name, but you know, off the record. And what has happened is that in the back rooms with the consultants, with the people who do the polling and the people who do the analysis and everything, they have concluded that if at this point in time, there's fewer than 100 days to go between now and the election, if an impeachment proceeding were to be initiated, it would so suck the air out of the room, out of the news cycles, that the election, that any good news that Obama might be able to get for himself would be completely subsumed by it. It'd just be eaten alive. And that the news networks would perceive that as the Democratic news for the day, so they'd still be covering John McCain for the Republican news of the day, because in their deluded fashion, they think that everything should be balanced, just like with global warming, right? And so, I mean, this, whether it's true or not, I can see their point at this point in time. I absolutely disagree as of 6 months ago and a year ago and 2 years ago. I mean, I've been calling for impeachment virtually from day one, certainly since George Bush invaded Iraq, you know, loudly in print and on this radio show. But in any case, the Democratic Party and the Democratic leadership and Nancy Pelosi representing them, they've made that, and this is not a conversation I've had with her, but I've had this conversation with a couple of elected Democrats. I know this to be the case. The party has come, and they believe that they've got the hard math on their side. They've come to the conclusion it would be destructive to Barack Obama's presidential aspirations to do impeachment. So what's plan B? Because no matter how hard we push for impeachment, they're not going to do it. But if we push hard enough, if we support Dennis Kucinich in this effort, if you go to Kucinich.us and sign the petition, that sort of thing, at the very least, hopefully what will come out of this is that more members of Congress will get it, that A, the Bush administration actually committed crimes. This isn't like Travelgate, where Hillary Clinton had a travel agent fired because she didn't think she was doing a particularly good job and didn't like the person or whatever the reason was. I don't think we ever did find out, although Congress spent millions of dollars investigating it and tried to get a special prosecutor involved in it. This isn't like that. We're talking about before 9/11. Keep in mind, the CEO of Quest Communications testified before Congress that before 9/11, within weeks of George Bush taking office after his appointment by the Supreme Court of the United States to be President of the United States, he was asking Quest to wiretap you and me. And it might have been me, because Quest is my phone company. I mean, it might have been. Long before 9/11. And this testimony is on the record. And then they got that guy's butt in jail as fast as they could. So in any case, the point is that at the very least, perhaps we can convince them that they should begin hearings into crimes, whether or not this is to lead to impeachment, hearings into the crimes of this administration and the complicity of Republicans in this, not just in this administration, but in Congress and outside of Congress. You know, look at like Laura Canary, the prosecutor down in Alabama who went after Don Siegelman, whose husband was Bob Riley, the current governor of Alabama, was his campaign manager. The guy who Don Siegelman says didn't actually beat him. They stole the election in the middle of the night by flipping votes in a voting machine. Or a tabulator or whatever. So anyhow, I believe that even though, realistically looking at it, impeachment is 99% a lost cause at this point. And yes, that infuriates me as much as it does you. Nonetheless, pushing on this, pushing on the point that these guys violated the Constitution, they didn't just break the law, they broke our Constitution, and that therefore they need to be held to account, it will dramatically increase the probability that hearings may begin in this congressional session, but more importantly, when we come back in January, when there is a larger majority of Democrats in the House and Senate, and there may well be a Democratic president, that those hearings will continue full force and may well lead to prosecutions not just for some of these so-called smaller things like FISA, but for war crimes, for crimes against humanity, for torture, for kidnapping American citizens and others and shipping them overseas and torturing them, for handing people off to foreign governments to be tortured. These things are against the law. These things wildly transform having, sex in the Oval Office. I mean, come on. This is serious stuff. So anyhow, I guess point made. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Your thoughts on these issues and others. Coming up right after this, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Broadcasting from behind the good old stainless steel working class microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Bush Sr. refers to the banks of the Willamette River, Portland, Oregon. Well, strange things going on in China. Our China alert for the day. I love this song. I believe it's from an opera that I saw when I was living in China in 1987 for a month. in Beijing. Anyhow, here it is. Amnesty International has accused the International Olympic Committee of caving in to China's demands on internet censorship and urged the IOC and Beijing to provide unfettered internet access as they had promised. I mean, here's the bottom line is that China said, sure, no problem. Journalists coming to China, we'll give them unfettered access to the internet. But the fact of the matter is that in all probability, if you're a journalist in China and you try to access maybe TomHartmann.com, who knows, AirAmerica.com, ThinkProgress.org, BuzzFlash.com, CommonDreams.org, OpEdNews.com, HuffingtonPost.com, you may not get through. You may not even get through to the New York Times. I mean, who knows? So our China alert for the day. The China backs out or reneges on their commitment to the IOC. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jake in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great.
Hey, I'd like to give you my choice for the vice presidential nominee for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
I think Virginia Governor Tim Kaine would be the best choice. And the main reason is, with Kaine on the ticket, Obama could potentially win Virginia. If John McCain can't count on those electoral votes, John McCain cannot win this election.
There's a lot going for Tim Kaine, and you know, when I was very skeptical actually when I first heard his name, and the more I see, the more I you know, the very progressive part of me is a little bit ambivalent because Tim Kaine is kind of, you know, in the middle, and he's moved around some on his positions, but on the other hand, the fact that he's moved around on some of his positions, I think is may well be a good sign because it means that he's a politician who listens to his constituents. And
right.
And if enough of us constituents out there can get loud enough, we need politicians who will listen to us. The last thing we want is another George W. Bush who says, this is the way it is. This is what I'm going to do. I don't care whether people like it or not. This is what I'm going to do. Yeah, you know, so, interesting. Thanks a lot, Jake. We should we'll have to do a straw poll on this one of these days here soon. Catherine in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Catherine.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hi. I called Nancy Pelosi's office yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and I talked about someone pretty much at length. Did she have a timeline to act, or why wasn't she acting on Karl Rove, impeachment, and a number of things? And so I said, let me put you through the comment line. So I get the comment line, and it's recording. This line cannot take messages at this time. So everyone who is being directed by Air America to call Nancy Pelosi's office is getting that drivel, and that only makes you more upset.
Wait a minute. Her comment, somebody said, were you directed by Air America to call Nancy Pelosi's office?
No. I didn't say anything about Air America. I just said that I am very upset, and I want to know if the speaker has a plan to delay this closer to the election, or is there any mind to take Karl Rove into handcuffs and, you know, in a building or in it. Anyway.
See, I think that while they're afraid of impeachment, and at this point in time...
Comment line, and there's no availability to leave a comment.
Yeah. But you might try again.
That's happened to Fine Stein's office, too.
Yeah.
And then they feel like you have no representation.
Yeah. I absolutely understand, Catherine. And
Richardson and Clark are my thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you for calling. I've had the exact same situation trying to call Gordon Smith's office, the Republican senator here in Oregon, and this is about a year ago. And it can be frustrating. I do believe that Speaker Pelosi... cleans those lines fairly regularly. It may just be that they were unusually slammed. We were calling for people to call her yesterday, and when that happens, but you know, don't give up. Keep trying. As I said, even if impeachment is off the table, which I think we can say with some certainty it is now at this point, although it shouldn't be. But you know, they're doing the political calculus. I don't see a political downside to prosecuting Karl Rove. I don't see a political downside to showing to the world the crimes of these people. I just don't see it. I think, you know, it's there. Mike in Albuquerque, New Mexico, KABQ. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. One of the first thing that I wanted to say was that I have discovered and subsequently supported local advertisers that are on your program.
Good on you, Mike. Good on
you. Yeah. My question was, why is it that the Republican, quote-unquote, base votes so consistently against its own interests? The poor rural farmer in Georgia does not receive the tax break that George Bush gives them.
Yeah, this is Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And in fact, he's going to be on our show in the next couple of days.
Excellent. And that was my question. Just real quick.
Yeah. Well, the reason, you know, in just very, very short summary is that the Republicans are very, very good at playing sleight of hand. You know, the old magician's trick of watch the right hand while the left hand is pulling the lever that pops the bunny into the hat kind of thing. And the Republicans say, let's all look at gays. Let's all look at the Bible. Let's all look at the Ten Commandments. Let's all look at, you know, the guns.
And
with their other hand, they're stealing our paychecks.
Are these people so ignorant that they don't see what's going on?
It's not that probably a few of them are, but I don't think that that's the vast majority of them. I think what's going on, Mike, is that people are working two and three jobs. I mean, this was one of the stories today in the New York Times. I mean, the number of Americans who've seen their full-time jobs dropped to part-time because of weak business has swelled to 3.7 million, the largest figure since the government began tracking such data more than half a century ago. So you've got people working two and three jobs to make the exact same income that they were making when they were working an eight-hour day. Now they're working 10, 12-hour days, 14-hour days. And they just don't have time. They don't have time to catch up. And when they do try to catch up, they get a 30-minute pablum break from the network news, which is, you know, at least out of that 30 minutes, you know, 8 minutes of its commercials out of the 22 minutes to 21 minutes of news in that 30 minutes. 30% of it at least is what's new with Britney Spears kind of stuff. There's no substantive discussion of the issues. And then quite a few of them live in parts of the country where the only kind of radio that they can hear is right-wing talk radio. And so they turn to that because they want some news. And the news that they get is full of lies. I mean, you got Hannity out there still lying. And it's a lie, Sean. It's a lie. You got Sean Hannity out there still going on about how Barack Obama wanted to bring in cameras to see the troops and wounded troops in Germany. It's a friggin' lie. And Sean Hannity is a liar. And, you know, Andrea Mitchell at least called John McCain out on this. But these, you know, folks across America, this is their source of news. And it's a downright tragedy. It's just a plain old flat out downright tragedy. Tom and Paul in New York. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hello.
Tom, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom? This is Tom without an H.
Okay.
I heard you mention... briefly ago, when you're talking about impeachment, and you mentioned afraid to impeach, and the word afraid seems to keep coming into my head, particularly with, say, Harry Reid or would Nancy Pelosi. But my question actually is, if we're afraid, we have to wait until Election Day. What can be done the day after Election Day? I mean, not even wait until they're finished in the courts in Ohio.
Well, literally the day after Election Day, I don't have the congressional calendar, but I'm not sure. I'm going to have to get back with you on that, Tom. The main thing that, frankly, I think all of us need to be doing is getting involved, getting politically active. You know, and thank you for the call. When a congressman comes or a congresswoman comes back to their district during these four-day weekends that they have, which are designed for them to go back to their districts, and many of them, the good ones, actually do that. They do go back to their districts. They do talk to people, even when they're saying things that people don't want to hear, even, you know, whatever. That, they do that. Bernie Sanders used to do, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 of these things a year, or these town halls all over Vermont. I mean, every single weekend he was in his district when I lived in Vermont. And I see the same thing with Congressman Peter DeFazio and Earl Blumenauer in the Portland area. I mean, and the people that they are listening to the most, if you want to have influence with a member of Congress, the people they listen to the most are the ones who sit around the table with them at the monthly or sometimes quarterly or sometimes even annually, it depends on where you are, but who sit around the table with them at the Democratic Party events, the fundraisers and the events where you get, you know, 50, 100, 200, 300 people sometimes. Sometimes it's as few as 5 or 10 people show up for these things. These are the people who are volunteering with the local party to go out on Election Day and walk districts, to walk precincts, to do canvassing, to raise funds, or they just show up. And if you want to have, you know, it's even more powerful than going to a town hall meeting. It's 1,000 times more powerful than making a phone call. And it's not that much work to say, okay, one night a week, or one night a month, rather, one night a month, or sometimes it's one night every other month. I mean, depending on where you live, I'm going to show up at the local Democratic Party and I'm going to get involved. And then you'll have the kind of influence over your congressman, over your member of Congress, that in many cases, particularly with Democratic members of Congress, that lobbyists have with Republican members of Congress. And that's what we need to be doing the day after Election Day, is getting out there and getting the message out. Hold them to account.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
We are taking our country back one district at a time, one dog catcher at a time, one mayor at a time, one senator at a time, right across the board. And today, for our Taking My Country Back segment, Henry Sanchez is with us. He was with AT&T for 32 years. Now he's a small businessman, in the communications industry. He's running for Congress in Michigan's 3rd district against Vern Ehlers. And Vern, the incumbent Republican, is going to be 74 years old, will have served in Congress for 15 years. And Henry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be with you. And, just thinking about his age, I didn't know how old Vern was, but I guess he could get on that golf course with Tom McCain and ride around that golf cart.
Yeah, and the older, and Poppy Bush, yeah.
By the way, I
should mention your website is Sanchez, S-A-N-C-H-E-Z, 4FORUSCongress.org. And don't forget the U.S. in there, Sanchez4USCongress.org. And Henry Sanchez, tell us a little bit about yourself and your positions on the issues in the Grand Rapids area, which is where you're running.
Yes, Tom, I would sure like to do that. Well, first of all, I am just an average American citizen, just like everybody else. I'm the small guy that everybody keeps talking about. They should be running for Congress. And I got involved because, I'm a veteran of the Vietnam era war, spent 3 years in the Army during that time, was with Fort Bridge Engineers. My father was with the Army during World War II. He was with the Armor Division. And we both pledged to support and protect the Constitution, and the Constitution has been stepped all over, and that makes me angry. So that is one of the reasons I am running, to put the teeth back in the Constitution. I am also running for the working class. When you figure that 2.3 million good living wage jobs have gone to China, more than 300,000 and change were Michigan jobs, and then people wonder where the tax base went. That is what's wrong with what's going on with America today. Nobody cares about the middle class. And like you say, we've had a war on the middle class for 30 years. It's time to change that. We have to bring good living wages back to America and put Americans back to work. Michigan has been devastated, and I see that every day on the faces of good living wage union people that have lost their jobs. You see what's happened to the Big Three. They've gone, the way of the dinosaur. We have to get some kind of a project back here in Michigan to bring those jobs back and help those three industries become the big industries they used to be. So that, that in itself is one of the reasons I am running. I had a case here in my district where an individual of 28 years old, without good health care, found out he had cancer of the rectum, and they wouldn't even operate on him until he could guarantee he'd come up with $14,000 to cover the deduction. So, first of all, he gets hit with that news, and then now he's got to, scramble to come up with the money to pay for it. He's a young guy. He's got a family of a wife and two kids, and it's sad what's going on here in America. It's not the America I grew up in, and I think we can do a heck of a lot better. We are here with a good moral conscience to do what we can do for not just ourselves but all of the environment. And, I'm a good Christian, and I do believe that God put us here not just for man, but for all the species that we have to take care of, and as well as the air, the land, and the water. And we have to do a lot better job than we're doing now. And I think, you know, with all the greed that's out there right now, we have to change that, because greed is what is controlling this country, and it is not good for any of us. So, you know, that is a lot of the reasons I'm running. Vern Ehlers voted for this illegal war that we went into, and then he didn't have the audacity to vote for the GI Bill. He voted against SCHIP for the kids. He voted against the Farm Bill, the best farm bill since 1949. And, you know, those are a lot of the reasons I am running. I'm just disgusted with what's happened to our country.
So here is our chance to help flip a red district blue in the United States Congress. Henry Sanchez running from the Grand Rapids area, the third congressional district of Michigan, and a good progressive Democrat running against a Republican incumbent. You can go to his website, Sanchez, S-A-N-C-H-E-Z, 4-F-O-R, U-S, Congress.org. Sanchez for USCongress.org. And toss a couple bucks his way, help him out, give him some moral support. No matter where you live in the United States, it's so important that we, particularly in a district like this, I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and one of my brothers lives just out a little bit out of town, and you know, I grew up in Michigan, right down the road in Lansing, so I'm very familiar with this area. Got a lot of relatives up there as well, particularly around Newaygo. And it is a largely Republican area that is surprisingly starting to turn toward the center and in many ways actually turning Democratic. I think you may have a good chance here, Henry, if we can get enough people supporting you, Henry Sanchez.
Well, thank you very much, Tom, and God bless everybody.
Yeah, and well, stick around for just another minute or two. I want to ask you what you gave a great stump speech there, and it was a really, really good summary. Where do you put your chances of winning this thing, and how does this race look to you? We have just a minute here.
Well, I think if I can get enough contributions to give this guy a run for his money, you know, I'm just an average guy. I don't have big bucks. And, you know, and the economy here in Michigan is so bad that you know, people seem to kind of pick certain areas that they want to throw their money into because they think people have a good chance of winning. Anything can happen, you know, and, you know, I just need support to get out there and get, you know, a fight, be a voice for the working class, and we can do this thing. You know, I've got the experience to do it, and I know that I stand for the people that I want to represent, which is the middle class and the poor, the 90% that are not represented now. And, you know, if I can get $5, $10, or $20 here and there, you know, we can take this fight to Mr. Ehlers and stop these free rides that these guys get, because people have been browbeated so long that they just give up.
Yeah, well said. Henry Sanchez running for the United States Congress in Michigan's 3rd District. Sanchez for USCongress.org. Get over there right now and help him out. Henry Sanchez, thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up, James Carafano. We're going to talk about whether the war, the anti-war movement, is dead or not. Stick around.
This is Tom Hartman. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our second hour. James Carafano is with us, Dr. James Carafano. He's the Assistant Director of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies and a Senior Research Fellow, the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org, their website, recently wrote a piece based on for the Heritage Foundation, which is also picked up by Fox News, titled The Wilting Anti-War Move. This is fascinating. James, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you. Why don't you lay out your thesis first?
Well, you know, I'm a historian by training, and I think what we're seeing with the anti-war movement in this war is traditionally what you see with anti-war movements in the United States and in democracies in general, and that's that anti-war movements tend I mean, I think the model that we tend to think of is we have an anti-war movement and then the cause spreads and then pretty soon everybody turns against the war. And I actually think that's not accurate. Typically what happens is there are always anti-war movements in good wars and bad wars. You name a war, going back to the American Revolution, there's been an anti-war movement. When anti-war movements move to prominence is really kind of when they run the bow wave of public opinion. When you have a war that doesn't appear to be going well, the American people, which tend to be relatively pragmatic, you know, don't mind spending their treasure and don't mind sending their sons and daughters off to battle as long as they feel that, one, the goal is just, and two, and this is where the pragmatism is, that they think the goal is achievable. As Americans start to doubt that, the popularity for the war goes down. Matter of fact, in every war we've ever had in our history, as wars have lengthened, the popularity of the war has gone down. There's only one exception to that, which is World War II, where popularity was remarkably high from Pearl Harbor on,
yeah,
and almost
came
down.
Yeah, but Pearl Harbor was a singular event, A, and B, in Tojo and Hitler, we had, you know, fairly definable bad guys.
and the
horrors.
And the other thing that was different about World War II, I mean, we spent half of our GDP on World War II. Everybody was involved in the war.
Yeah, it was an absolute shared sacrifice. Now, where I find this fascinating, you use the example, in fact, of World War II. You mentioned, you know, Lindbergh was part of the anti-war movement. In fact, Rex Stout, as you probably know, wrote a book called The Illustrious Dunderheads, in which he summarized the speeches of a whole bunch of largely Republican members of Congress on the floor of the House and Senate calling for us not to take on Hitler because he wasn't such a bad guy.
Right.
There was a strong anti-war movement.
Very divided, absolutely.
The Republican Party was just absolutely no. We're not going to go to war against Adolf Hitler, and broadly. But the point that you're making that the current anti-war movement is faltering, I would like to respectfully disagree with and suggest to you that instead what you have documented. I mean, I look at the exact same data you are and draw a completely different conclusion, which is that. And I think that we saw the same thing with the woman suffrage movement. We saw the same thing with the abolition movement. We saw the same thing with the movement toward the American Revolution in the 1750s, 60s, and 70s. We saw the same thing. I can give you, you know, the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the movement for the Great Society in the 1960s and 70s, is that what begins as a movement, as Tom Hayden, who was just brilliantly, we were in Croatia together a while back, and he laid this whole hypothesis out for me. You know, he says, you know, he used to be in the movement, you know, in the SDS. He was one of the founders of SDS. And then he became a state senator in California, and he became part of the Machiavellis. And, you know, basically what happens is that when the movement achieves some level of critical mass acceptance, you know, it starts out as 5%, 10% of the people, 15% of the people, And when it hits maybe 30 or 40 or even 50% of the people, it ceases to be a movement because, not because it's no longer a movement, not because it's lost its power, but because it's now us. And in the case of this anti-war movement right now, more than half of Americans are opposed to our you know, the ongoing occupation of Iraq. So I would submit to you that the anti-war movement hasn't gone anywhere. It has been incredibly effective because it has flipped the perceptions of all of the Americans, or the largest percentage of Americans, and they, the movement, or, you know, speaking from your point of view, has become us, all of America.
Yeah, and I think that conclusion is just flat wrong. I think what you're seeing is the majority of Americans became very concerned about the war effort and on their own without the anti-war movement, much as they did during Vietnam. And I also,
how could that be? I mean, the anti-war movement is the one who is out there saying, here's why we shouldn't be in the war. How are Americans going to come to that conclusion without an anti-war movement?
And the anti-war movement was largely marginalized until Tet 68, when you had the combination of Westmoreland coming back, testifying before the Congress, saying, the light is at the end of the tunnel, we're winning, things are going well. And then you had an invasion of the North into the South, and then the rise up of the Viet Cong, and it was all over the television. Things looked terrible, and the American people thought that they'd simply been lied to. And the American people largely turned against them.
But they wouldn't have thought that if there weren't people in the anti-war movement out there speaking out and putting that meme into the air in the first place.
Well, there are always people speaking out against the war.
That's the anti-war movement.
But that doesn't mean it actually moves public opinion. I mean, even during World War II, there was a dedicated group of anti-war activists throughout World War II that vociferously opposed the war effort, even during the course of the war. The question is whether they're driving public opinion or just reflecting it.
No, but the anti-war movement that continued during World War II became basically an anti-all-war movement. The only people who were actively opposed to World War II once we entered World War II were a few fringe members of the American Nazi Party that were still left over and quickly hiding themselves. And B, basically the people who were religiously pacifists, you know, a few Quakers here and there, that sort of thing. People who historically have opposed all wars. And they weren't just specifically opposing World War II. They were opposing all wars.
Well, I think
that's a whole different thing from an anti-war movement. That's a pacifist movement.
I mean, I think you fundamentally hit on the key issue, which is the key central point of the debate. And you're right in the sense that there are movements that become, that translate into broad political power. And I think the civil rights movement is a great example of that.
And the suffrage movement and the abolition movement.
Yeah, but I think to conglomerate all movements as, in a sense, having that effect, I think is wrong. And
here's where I'd identify the difference.
Anti-war movements don't fit that model, and they don't become broad social movements. They, in a sense, disintegrate.
Well, not if you're going to use the anti-war movement of World War I and World War II, I agree with you. But here's the difference. And World War One is still baffles me, by the way. And this is a whole separate discussion.
Yeah,
I still,
true.
You know, I have spent a lot of time studying World War One, and I still can't give you. I can't give you a good reason why we fought that war. But setting that aside, and because you know Woodrow Wilson passed the Alien Sedition Act and was actually putting people in jail who would have said what I just said.
Right.
A dark day in American history. But
absolutely.
Nonetheless, and he a Democrat at that. But nonetheless, my point is that the suffrage movement, the movement for women's rights.
Right.
was morally correct.
And became a broad social
they were honest.
Argument. Same
the abolition movement was morally correct.
And
the American Revolution
Absolutely.
Was morally correct.
Right.
The Vietnam War was morally wrong, and the anti-war movement was morally correct. The Iraq War was morally wrong and illegal, and the anti-war movement was morally correct. So I would submit to you that what we're seeing is that those movements that actually have truth at their core become so large in the public that they transcend movement, and they become the Machiavellis, to use Tom Hayden's phrase. They become the general body politic, whereas those movements that don't have truth at their core, you know, the Nazis support, you know, saying that we should get out of World War II and let Hitler take Europe, they die.
Well, I mean, you're just using QED. What I believe therefore becomes. I mean, Hitler.
No, I'm using the examples of history.
Wait a second. Nazism in World War II became a broad social movement and penetrated every element of society, and it was the greatest evil and the dumbest idea ever. So that just kind of knocks your thesis out right there.
But no, but it didn't
I mean, it
do
was a
what
non-truth.
The anti-war movement has done with Iraq. It didn't become consensus. In the case of Vietnam, we reached a point where the anti-war movement that started out as maybe 5 or 10% of the population became more than 50% of the population.
No, and then we ended the war.
No,
you're equating popular opinion with the effect of the anti-war movement, which
I am.
Is just inaccurate. Well, you're just
I'm saying when the movement is right, the public figures that out. The American people are not stupid. And when the movement is stupid or wrong, as the Nazis were in World War II, the American Nazis were in World War II, then the movement doesn't get traction because the American people are not stupid.
Well, the Germans obviously didn't figure it out because it took their country getting conquered to be told that their ideology was wrong.
That's right. There was not an anti-war movement of any consequence in Germany.
Here's where you're right.
You had the White Rose Society, and Hitler murdered them all.
Some movements transform societies and some don't. In American history, anti-war movements tend not to do that.
In us, the war is morally wrong. Look at the Korean War. The Korean War was arguably morally wrong. And you had Dwight Eisenhower run on a campaign of vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. That's what his TV ad said.
Right.
There was an anti-war movement.
And then Eisenhower went in and continued to fight the war.
He ended the war.
I mean, the anti-war movement in the Korean War was negligible. And what happened to the anti-war movement in Vietnam after the end of the draft? It dissolved.
Right, because it became us. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we're both right.
Great discussion, though.
Yeah, it is. James Carafano.
Right issue,
yeah, thank you very much. James Carafano, heritage.org, if you want to read all about it. Thank you very much for being
with
us.
Thanks for having me. Great.
Yeah, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
Ships that save the world in dark. some CEOs. Where a simple, decent living is right that we all share. When the suits see us as people, not just assets to be paired. When they can't just ship your job off, cause it's happening everywhere. That is one big million.
21 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. And downright crazy, it's getting out there, downright crazy. One day after Senator John McCain broadcast an anti-Obama ad in which he compared the presumptive Democratic nominee to celebrities Paris Hilton and Britney Spears, as we hear on the wire services here, the two tabloid mainstays fought back with an eviscerating anti-McCain spot of their own. While Mrs. Spears and Hilton said they had planned to remain on the sidelines during the 2008 presidential campaign, Senator McCain's negative ad, quote, left us no choice, the notorious party gal said today. We don't mind John McCain going after us if he sticks to the facts, Mrs. Spears said at a New York press conference, but we are sick of the distortions about our record. Ms. Hilton said that the McCain ad appeared to link herself and Ms. Spears to Senator Obama, leading the casual viewer to conclude that the three of them had, quote, the same energy policy. Nothing could be further from the truth, said Ms. Spears. Both of us strongly favor offshore drilling to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Ms. Hilton said she was also offended by the implication that she and Ms. Spears favor a tax on electricity. We have both been very clear on that issue. In their anti-McCain spot, the two starlets fight fire with fire, comparing Senator McCain to the Joker from the smash hit film The Dark Knight. It's perfectly fair, Ms. Spears said of the ad. They both have pasty white faces and totally creepy smiles. Elsewhere, Chinese Olympic officials confiscated the poles of the pole vaulting team to prevent athletes from going over the wall. Mm-hmm. That, of course, actually from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. But there is actually a weird little element of strangeness to this. You've seen the ad, the Barack Obama ad, the John McCain ad, anti-Obama, that has Paris Hilton and Britney Spears in it. Of course, he did it knowing that the media would pick it up like crazy and run it all over the place. But let's hear the real Britney. This courtesy of Progressive Accountability. You can also find this over the YouTube of this over at the front page of DailyKos.com. Britney Spears being interviewed, asked about George W. Bush. What do you think about George W. Bush, Britney?
Honestly, I think we should just trust our president in every decision that he makes, and we should just support that, you know, and be faithful in what happens.
Do you trust this president?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so Brittany, she thinks he's just fine. And then, of course, John McCain was asked the same question on Meet the Press. So do you trust this president?
Do you have confidence in the president and his national security team to lead the war at this stage?
I do. I do. I have confidence in the president, and I believe that he is well aware of the severity of the situation.
Now, that was 2 years ago this week, by the way. 2 years ago. So that is how strange it gets. I don't know, what can I say? That is how strange it gets. By the way, just to wrap up the topic of the last hour, the Germans accepted defeat. And not one American soldier was killed in the occupation of Germany or Japan by hostile fire after World War II. The Germans and the Japanese accepted defeat because they realized what the anti-war movement, or what the pro-war movement, actually, in the United States in World War II realized, which is that the Germans were wrong. What the anti-war movement in Germany realized, the White Rose Society, these young men and women who were brutally murdered, and their memory and tradition being maintained by Ben Birch and others at WhiteRoseSociety.org and other great sites. Of course, you can Google them, find out all about it. There's even been a movie made about them. But also, let's point out, Dwight Eisenhower was invoked in the last segment. This is Dwight Eisenhower's 1952 campaign ad referring to the war in Korea, the ongoing, unpopular war in Korea. And who was a member of the anti-war movement? This is Dwight Eisenhower's 1952 television ad. It shows an elephant going across a stage, pounding a drum, right? The GOP pounding a drum across a cartoon elephant on a cartoon stage, sort of like a Disney thing. And here's the voiceover.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower, a paid film.
Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. See, what people don't get is that there is this, there was a cult that was created in Germany. There were cults created in Germany and Japan. In Japan, you had the emperor worship cult, you know, the belief that Hirohito was absolutely, he was divine, that the emperor was literally descended from the sun, that was a divine being and could do no wrong. And in Germany, you had Germans who actually believed that Hitler was going to bring about 1,000 years of peace, that he was the reincarnation of Jesus Christ, that he was going to bring about the return of Jesus, that he was, and this was a largely Christian movement, not unlike this whole movement that's going on right now about, you know, let's have a war in the Middle East so Jesus will return. And the Third Reich was all about 1,000 years of peace. And people bought into this cult. It was a cult. And when they were awakened out of that cult at the end of World War II, when they saw the horrors, when the Japanese saw the horrors of the rape of Nanking, when the Germans saw the horrors of the death camps and the concentration camps, they said, oh my God, we were members of a cult. How could we have been? And in America right now, Americans are starting to wake up and say, you know, that George W. Bush, those guys, it's a crazy cult. And we don't want to have anything to do with it. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Like me and you.
By and large, yeah.
I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them.
Yeah.
But I'm a liberal.
He's
well, there's
liberal.
That.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, and I'm telling you, the stories are coming fast and furious. We've got another strange bird alert.
Farmer had raised chickens since he was 24, all working for the colonel for 30 years or more, killing all the chickens and sending them to fry. Now it's payback time for ghost chickens in the sky.
Pigeon alert here. I got an email from Jerry in Forest Grove. Jerry says, hey, I know one place the robot pigeons must go for programming to life on Earth. Honolulu. My husband and I just came back from a week there. There were pigeons of various sizes, shapes, and coloring. They were very people-friendly, begging for tidbits, etc., yet we never saw any pigeon poop on sidewalks, buildings, or any place where people always see it in crowded cities with lots of pigeons. Therefore, we think Honolulu must be some sort of way station in their training. Obviously, these are not biological birds, since there was no pigeon poop. They probably learned to do that illusion at some other way station.
Because there's no more painful death than to be rotisserie. Please go have a burger and pass the colonel by, and maybe you'll survive. Ghost chickens in the sky.
Everybody!
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Yeah, I'm telling you, those pigeons, they're actually from the planet Xenu. They're actually robots. What do you have whenever you have world leaders? Pigeons. And why do you never see dead pigeons or baby pigeons? Because they're robots. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Jason in Long Beach, California. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Tom. First of all, thank you for all you do, man. Really appreciate it.
That's quite all right. You know what? The last caller opened his call instead of thanking me by saying, I support our advertisers. And I would love to hear callers say, I'm calling because I support your advertisers.
Fair enough. Point taken.
Okay. What's up, Jason?
Well, I just wanted to get your opinion. I had a thought the other day, and maybe you've touched on it before, but do you think that like the current devaluation of the dollar is deliberate by kind of the corporate or power structure, you know, to bring the peso, or to bring it more in line with the peso and the Canadian dollar, to make the Amero more palatable or reasonable, or, you know, more of a necessity.
I know that there's a substantial, and I don't say conspiracy theory in a dismissive way, but there's a substantial number of people who believe that this Amero is coming, that the goal is to not just harmonize Canada, the United States, and Mexico as, you know, NAFTA, but actually to have a single currency. I don't believe that that's going to happen. I'm not even close to it. I do think that there is manipulation of our currency to prevent an absolute screaming disaster, and you've got a bunch of countries in the world that are participating in that manipulation, i.e. supporting the dollar, because they have so many investments in the dollar. They're sitting on so many dollars, and because dollars can be used to buy oil. So that's, you know, but no, I don't go there, Jason. We'll see, you know, but I just don't think it's going to happen. Terry in Monterey, California, listening to KRXA. Hey, Terry.
Tom, first of all, I want to compliment your program superbly, and your wisdom and your efforts to improve the American national dialogue and comprehension of political and other realities.
Thank you, Terry. Support the advertisers on KRXA,
please. KRXA is my local station in Monterey, and I want to give them a boost. They are a fantastic local station.
Yeah, I agree.
Again, as you well know.
Yep. Hal Ginsberg does a wonderful job there.
My perspective includes dealing with three White House administrations as a senior military officer, mm-hmm. including the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not a Republican nor a Democrat, although my leans used to be Republican. And you've encouraged me to absolutely vote only progressive, by the way, listening to you for a year now.
Thank you, Terry.
If you will, directed me that direction. More significantly, before I jump onto the Bush-Cheney, it really should be called the Cheney Bush administration's crimes and why military families are going to come out against the war. You several times, including this morning, you made light of Bill Clinton's perjury, and you said it was just sex in the White House, to paraphrase you accurately.
Mm-hmm.
Please understand, I was there, and it was not just sex. The man committed perjury on videotape, violated federal laws, encouraged other people to commit perjury, et cetera.
Yeah,
and that is to bring up the other criminal conduct of Bill and Hillary. And we have Bush and Cheney, damn it, because the Clintons didn't do the right thing and have Bill resign as a point of integrity, and the Democrats in the Senate didn't go down and tell him, leave so Gore can be president for 21 months before the next election.
Terry, I respectfully disagree. You're absolutely right that Bill Clinton was not impeached for having sex. He was impeached for lying about it. And you're absolutely right that lying before a grand jury is a crime. But being brought before a grand jury because you had sex in the White House was, in my opinion, a political crime to begin with. This was a witch hunt by the Republicans, Terry. Terry, I understand that, and he never should have done that. But the deposition should never have been held in the first place. If every the idea of dragging a president before a federal grand jury about whether or not he had sex with a consenting adult while he's in the White House is, in my mind, crazy.
No, he
particularly
committed
federal
when
you
law
got,
by doing that with a subordinate.
Particularly when you have people today trying to compare that crime, which I will acknowledge was a crime, even though I consider it to be a minor one, that crime with the crime of spying on Americans illegally, even before 9/11, the crime of lying us into a war. There are people dead right now as a consequence of George Bush's actions.
The significance of the Cheney Bush criminal conduct up and down. I concur with every item.
Bill Clinton had, you know, got it on with Monica Lewinsky, and nobody died. Hundreds of thousands of people are dead as a result of the lies of George W. Bush. Terry, this is orders of magnitude different.
We respectfully disagree on whether Clinton should have been removed for perjury, which is a high crime and misdemeanor. I concur completely. The evidence is overwhelming that Bush and Cheney have manipulated not only the intelligence, but they have committed, as Bugliosi lays out superbly in his book, murder.
Yes.
I wanted to focus on Mr. Carafano's comments, though, as a courtesy to you on what was your later theme in your program, and that is the anti-war issues.
Yeah.
I predict you are going to see military families, especially among the 4,200 who have been killed, and those wounded, lots of the wounded and the maimed, come out and demand not only further hearings on the issues, but to say recognition, national recognition.
Yeah. There is a group called Military Families Speak Out.
Oh,
there
yeah.
is the Gold Star Mothers for Peace, which Cindy Sheehan helped start, and they've been very active. And what's really interesting is some of the most recent fundraising numbers seem to indicate that the largest recipient of campaign contributions from active duty personnel serving overseas is Barack Obama.
I fully agree with that. So, I'm aware of that anecdotally from talking to hundreds of people.
Yeah, so it's happening. Terry, I got to move along.
Okay,
thanks a lot for the call.
You're a great American, and even though we disagree on that. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Terry. Appreciate it, and thanks for listening on KRXA. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Bonnie in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Bonnie.
Tom?
Yeah.
Hi. I was getting back to this impeachment and a related issue. I would like to know what credence you lend to that story that was floating around about both Bush the elder and Bush the younger buying a massive amount of property down in South America.
In Paraguay.
In Paraguay. Okay.
Right.
I forgot that.
Yeah. One
well,
of the few countries that does not have an extradition treaty with the United States.
Exactly. And so, yeah. You know, he'll escape impeachment, but he'll thus avoid prosecution for war crimes. And also, this land, they're sitting on tons of water, and
yeah.
water's going to become
yeah,
more valuable
it
than oil.
It looks like the reason why they bought this land, assuming that the reports are correct, and I have, you know, they've been reported by some fairly credible sources, is that
Except
it was a
here.
Business... Yeah, is that it was a business investment, but it is a very convenient one. And you know, Bonnie, thanks for raising the topic. I think that Bush is eventually going to be looking at the same thing Pinochet did. I don't think he's going to get away with this. I don't think the world is going to let him get away with this. But anyhow, we'll see. Michael in Portland, Oregon, you wanted to disagree about perjury. We got just a minute before the
yeah,
break
here.
Yeah,
a fine point. But my understanding of the definition of the term. Perjury is that the thing that you are lying about in the deposition or before the court or during the proceeding is supposed to be germane to the thing that you're being deposed
about. That was my point, that the original process itself was flawed. Also,
well,
let's keep in mind that when Bill Clinton was actually tried for perjury, when they actually held a trial for him for perjury, he was not convicted. That trial was held in the United States Senate.
Right. He has not been convicted of perjury, and nor does what he was accused of or the quote-unquote lie he told fall under the definition of perjury.
Right. Although then the other side would say, yeah, but, you know, he voluntarily gave up his law license and paid a fine, in Arkansas. In exchange for not being prosecuted. So, you know,
but
my whole point and your point is that why are we having, why was the United States even having a discussion about whether or not the President of the United States was having sex in the White House? I don't care. It doesn't affect me. But if the President of the United States is lying to me about the threat posed by another nation and then spending $2 trillion of my money and killing a couple of hundred thousand people, that does affect me. 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Real Democracy Zone. Tom Hartman here with you. Amazing, some of the pet story. I just have to mention this. Some of these pet stories. First of all, we did a crazy alert a couple days ago on this 40-plus pound cat. And now, what was his name? Powder, or her name. And now the rest of the story is coming out. The reason that this cat became homeless and was found wandering around homeless is because the owner was foreclosed. The owner became homeless. And here's another one. This is amazing. This is Bob Michalosko, the KTLA news reporter. And I'm sorry, and that was the dog's owner. And the KTLA news reporter, Chip Yost, Here's a story out of L.A. This is amazing. And it helps if I turn the volume up, doesn't it? Yeah. Here we go. Okay.
Part of the envelope says, please help him. His name is Kaiser, and he won't harm anyone. He's 16 years old, and I think he's experienced two strokes this past evening.
This was a dog dropped off at the Humane Society with an envelope saying, I think my dog has had a couple of strokes. Please help him.
The dog left on the doorstep of the pet clinic was sick. The letter left with him, heartbreaking.
Dear doctors, please forgive me for this horrible transgression. I have nowhere else to turn, so I ask you to mercifully, gently, and lovingly, please help him sleep. He's been my friend, my teacher, my pupil, my lifelong, loving, and loyal companion. I'm a homeless, disabled vet, and I know when it's time to say goodbye to a friend, and it's time now. He's such a part of my being. I'll once again be alone in my life. I love you, Kaiser. Thank you for caring. Sincerely, Kaiser's soulmate.
So what the local Humane Society did, they actually had a fund from the family of a former employee who had died to care for animals. And so they nursed this dog back to health. It turned out he hadn't had a stroke. They ran ads in the paper saying, hey, you know, we've got this dog, or ran an article about it, released it to the news media. And this homeless vet comes forward and says, oh, you've got my dog. And he's still alive, you know, because it turned out he couldn't afford to put the dog down. He couldn't afford to get health care for the dog. He couldn't afford anything. And a friend yelled, knocking on the garage door of his where he lived. He says, where he's living rent-free with a friend. He says, your dog's on the front page of the Daily News. Kaiser's still alive. He says, I stood there on the street reading the story and bawling my eyes out. I just spent a week in pain and tears thinking he was gone, and now here he is still alive. So the pet stories have this edge to them, which goes back to this story that right now home foreclosure filings rose 14% in the second quarter, the eighth consecutive quarterly climb, and more than doubled during the same period a year earlier. So this wonderful economy that you see at the front page of Drudge, the soft or dangerous economy that you see on the front page of the Financial Times and the New York Times, it is catching up with Americans. We do a segment periodically here on the show where we bring on an advertiser to one of our local affiliate stations all over the country and give them a minute to pitch their products and a minute to tell us how the ads are working, and in the hopes that those of you who are listening, wherever you may be, anywhere in the United States, who may have a small business or even a large business or medium-sized business, and you're thinking, you know, should I advertise on Progressive Talk Radio? Does it actually work? That you'll consider calling up one of our local stations and saying, hey, you know, I'd like to do something. Dana and Greg Boyce opened Corbett Fish House on October 1st in 2002. Corbett Fish House, actually one of my favorite restaurants here in Portland, Oregon, and an advertiser on KPOJ. Greg Boyce is with us. The website, by the way, CorbettFishHouse.com. Hey, Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
And, you know, give us your one-minute pitch for Corbett Fish House, first of all.
Well, we've got Portland's best fish and chips, and we're the only restaurant on the West Coast that serves a Midwest fish fry, like the good old Friday night fish fry that we used to have in Green Bay.
Yeah, I noticed you have Packer fries on the menu.
Well, it's all Packers here.
Yeah, it really is, which was, you know, kind of surprising to see in Portland. I love the Green Bay Packers. You know, that's the only team in America that's actually democratic. They're actually owned by their community, as opposed to by you know, being owned by some rich guy someplace.
That's right. And in case people don't get the Packer fry connection, it's French fries smothered with cheddar cheese and jalapenos, green and gold.
Yeah,
like the Packers.
And the other thing that's great about Corbett Fish House is that I can eat pretty much anything on your menu because it's all
gluten free.
It's all gluten free, right? And I have celiac disease, and there's so few restaurants that I can eat in, and it's just marvelous food. Greg, you've been advertising on AM 620 KPOJ here in Portland for a while. How's it working?
It's worked better than any other advertising I've ever done. You know, there's so many different media out there, and we've tried most of them, and I have never seen anything work like radio, and I have never seen a radio station work like KPOJ has.
That's
and
great.
I really mean that.
That's great. Greg, thanks so much for coming on, and thanks in particular, thanks so much, Corbett Fish House and Hawthorne Fish House here in Portland for running great restaurants. I had lunch at Corbett Fish House yesterday. Louise and I had lunch there. I mean, we're regulars.
Well, we really appreciate your support. Every day people mention you talking about us.
That's great. Greg, thanks a lot for coming on
our
show.
Thanks, Tom. All right.
And for advertising. And the website, of course, CorbettFishHouse.com if you want to check it out. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina. We got a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour. Andre, what's up? Andre? You are... You're on the air.
I'm doing fine, and you keep me feeling upbeat. You were talking to your last guest, and he was mentioning anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
And you taught me to not refer to the war as a war, but an occupation.
Right.
So I'm going to offer a small critique. Could you call the anti-war movement the peace movement so that we can acknowledge our legacy of spreading peace, you know, in the Vietnam War? And
it's a good point. I would not do that, though, Andre, because the peace movement is a completely different thing. There are people who are pacifists who believe that war is criminal under all circumstances, that no war should be fought. You know, Mahatma Gandhi, for example, counseled Churchill that he should not fight back against the Nazis, that he instead should allow the Nazis to invade England because the cost of human lives from a war would be so high. Gandhi, in my opinion, was wrong in that regard. But there are people who, of good conscience, who I have tremendous respect for, who believe that all wars are wrong. And that's the true peace movement. So there's two things going on at once. There is the anti-occupation of Iraq movement. There was the anti-invasion, a true anti-war movement early on. And then there is also a peace movement, a pacifistic peace movement in the United States that deserves a lot more attention and a lot more respect, frankly. Andre, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back with Larissa Alexandrovna.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Just imagine that you're a good American, that you have devoted your life to public service, that you have not gotten rich on it, unlike, say, Billy Towson, you know, the guy who lobbied for the Medicare donut hole and then took a $2 million a year job as the head of pharma, the big lobbying group for big pharma, for big pharmaceutical companies. You haven't gotten rich on it. You've been a Secretary of State, you've been a prosecutor, an Attorney General, you've been a governor, and because you're a Democrat, the Republicans decide to go after you. And they successfully arrest you, prosecute you on trumped-up charges, and put you in prison. Sounds like something out of the USSR. And yet it happened to Don Siegelman, it happened to Paul Meyer, it's happening in the United States right now. With us, Larissa Alexandrovna, I think the finest working journalist in America, or her and Greg Palast. We could have a hell of a competition between the two of you. But and she's working over at rawstory.com. And Larissa Alexandrovna,
Strasvidya. Da.
Strasvidya, Tamarish. So tell me, we have had Don Siegelman on this program probably a half dozen times. We've been doing regular updates. In fact, he was on the show, I think, Monday of this week.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our listeners are familiar with his case, although it probably bears a quick review. I just did that. But I don't think most people know about Mr. Minor.
No. And that's, I think, is a problem, because if you look at just the Siegelman case, then you can argue it's an isolated incident. But if you start looking, you know, across the country and seeing this happening in other states to other people, it starts to look like a pattern.
So who is Paul Meyer?
Paul Meyer was, or is rather, a Mississippi trial attorney who's best known for his work in the 1990s taking on big tobacco. He, for whatever reason, I mean, and certainly I have my views on what the reason is, he was targeted, or the allegation is he was targeted, because he was one of the largest Democratic donors in the South and the largest in Mississippi. He went to trial on allegations of bribing judges, three of them, one current sitting Supreme Court justice in the state of Mississippi by the name of Oliver Diaz, and the other two are John Whitfield and Wes Teal. The first trial, everyone's
I'm sorry, Diaz is acquitted completely. The other three are acquitted of most of the charges. Then they're, again, indicted. And this time, while Diaz is acquitted, the other three are not. So basically, and just if you're wondering what the crime actually was, the crime was, the alleged crime was bribery. But the judge in the case basically told the jurors that quid pro quo didn't have to be proven. That's A. B, that let me rewind here, actually.
Well, let me just summarize this really quickly, Larissa.
Doug, yeah.
wasn't this campaign contributions?
Right. These were campaign.
And if you give a campaign contribution and you don't expect anything in return for it, that's a campaign contribution, not a bribe. A bribe is where you expect something in return. And the judge said to the jury,
right,
if this guy gave them money, it doesn't matter if he got anything in return for it. You have to consider that a bribe. When, in fact, the rest of America considers that a campaign contribution. And then they took this guy and threw his butt in jail.
Right. But more importantly, it's not against the law to give money to judges in Mississippi. That's A and B. Diaz, who was acquitted twice, didn't even sit on any of the cases that involved any minors.
He was just somebody that he was philosophically aligned with. So here we have Paul Miner. Now he's in prison,
correct. And
his wife is dying of cancer. This guy that the Republicans targeted, that they pursued to the end of the earth, that this corrupt judge gave lousy jury instructions to, and take it from here.
Okay, so yes, he's in jail. Now, as I said, they all went to trial again, the three, not Diaz, and they were convicted. And during the second trial, his wife, a minor's wife, developed breast cancer, which has since spread to her brain and lungs. And as of last month, she's no longer receiving any medication but pain management. So she's in the last stages. And he's been trying to get out on appeal bond. But that has been denied from day one. And this is what the latest surrounds. This is the appeal motion and the government's response. Now, what had happened was, I think we can all agree that if this had happened to us, that is to say we were prosecuted twice and for something that wasn't a crime, and our spouse developed cancer, and I might add that there was a hurricane that destroyed his house at that time, so your home is destroyed, the guy starts drinking. I think most of us would likely douse ourselves in alcohol at this point. So he starts drinking, but this is not a crime. He doesn't do anything. In other words, he doesn't drive while under the influence. So it's really not a court issue. But what happens is that because of his drinking, the judge sends him to an alcohol program for alcoholics. Which he completes, and he's fine, and he does well and whatnot. But there was a series of issues leading up to this where on one occasion he was at a hotel, and he was drinking at the hotel. And that was one of the things the government is now citing as why he is a threat to the community and why he cannot get out on appeal bond.
Somebody who's never been even convicted of drunk driving.
That's correct. So in other words, the federal government is getting involved in treating alcoholism where alcohol is not even related to any of the alleged crimes.
Right.
It's truly bizarre. But
this is is it possible that this is all an attempt to keep Paul Miner from doing what Don Siegelman is doing now, that after I think it was 7 months in prison, incommunicado, locked down, being moved from jail to jail so the media couldn't get to him? Don Siegelman is now speaking out and calling for Karl Rove to go to jail. Do you think that this is to prevent Paul Miner from doing the same thing?
Well, I have no evidence to that, but my opinion is yes. And I should point out that in Siegelman's case, he was the media was not allowed near him. We could not contact him in any way.
Right.
Whereas with Paul Miner, there appears to be no prohibition, but yet when I've sent in my the visitor information form so I can get permission to go see him, they tell me the Bureau of Prisons tells me they've lost it.
Yeah.
So when you start to see things like that happen, you think, okay, is this coincidence? Is this
the thick hand of Karl Rove?
Well, I don't know
and
directly
minions.
Karl Rove.
Yeah.
It's not as easily tied into Karl Rove.
But, let's say this whole idea that the reason why you have prosecutors is to use them on your political opponents.
Yes, and that's really what's going on
here. And that's what's going on here. This guy was, you know, one of the largest contributors to Democratic causes in Mississippi, and he was a successful trial lawyer against
that's
the tobacco
right.
companies, who are good buddies with the Republicans, and so they took him down.
Right, and they also used these indictments to wave against the then Democratic Governor Ronnie Musgrove,
right?
Saying, you know, he's in league with these guys and whatnot. In fact, they're
right.
still using what happened back then during the current campaign. So it's
in other words, they're saying this convicted felon gave money to the now Democratic governor or to the Democrat who's running and et cetera.
Right.
So, Larissa, is there any, you know, what can our listeners do to help or support Paul Miner in his attempts to get justice and to at least see his wife before she dies?
Well, I think the best thing to do is to continue. I know we're all kind of cynical at this point, but to continue trying to reach out to Congress and putting pressure on them to speak about this, to request information from Attorney General Mukasey, also to reach out to the mainstream media who, for whatever reason, although it took them a long time to get on the Siegelman bandwagon, they're not even touching the Miner case.
Yeah.
So, it would be nice if some other people got involved.
Yeah, Dan Abrams did a great job with Siegelman, and 60 Minutes did a reasonably good job with Siegelman, and you're right. There has been no mention of Paul Miner at all. So contact Congress. Is there a website? Does Paul Miner have a website? Is there any group, advocacy group?
There is not yet a website, but I understand that Bishop Doss, who is a pastor to the family, is actually putting one together. So as soon as I have that information, I will forward that to you.
Great, and we will put it on our website, and we'll forward it along to our listeners. And, of course, you'll put it up on Raw Story, I'm assuming.
We'll definitely write about it.
Larissa Alexandrovna, rawstory.com. Larissa, thank you so much.
До свидания.
Yeah, до свидания. Thanks so much for the work, great work you do and for being on our program as well.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Conversation in the last segment. If you want to support Don Siegelman, this is the one of our greatest chances, I think, to expose this rotten to the core, corrupt. It's not just corrupt. It is like the mafia. It's a criminal organization. The Modern Republican Party. Go to contemptforrove.com. Contempt, contemptforrove.com. And help out Don Siegelman there. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Eric in Seattle. Hey, Eric, on Talk 1090. What's up?
Hey, I heard this thing recently. I wanted to get your input on the possibility of this. It seems kind of far-fetched to me, but this guy, George Green, was recently interviewed about a week ago, and he's an economist kind of person. He's a banker. Mm-hmm. And deals with the financial sector a lot, and he's predicting that in September 30th, which is the end of our fiscal year, basically the U.S. is going to be bankrupt in the eyes of the rest of the world because of our deficit and the housing market crash and the bailing out of companies. Basically, we're printing more money and borrowing more money than we can sustain.
I don't think it's going to happen. In fact, I don't think it could happen, Eric. The bankruptcy of the United States, the destruction of our economic system,
wouldn't happen that fast.
Exactly. The destruction of the dollar is something that's going to happen in slow motion, just like it did during the Great Depression. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see the Dow over the course of maybe a 6-month period, like it did in 1929, drop by 50%. You know, drop down into the 6,000-7,000 point region. I mean, keep in mind the Dow was at like what 1,200, 1,800, 1,300. I don't remember actually the number, but it certainly was under 3,000 when Bill Clinton came into office. I mean,
he was expecting the housing market dropping 50% in the next 6 to 12 months also.
Yeah, and see, that's what happened in 27 and 28. If you go back and you look, and you can even Google this, there's some very good reporting done on this, but in particular what you want to read are the original old stories which have been reposted on the web from the New York Times back in, and from the Miami paper, I forget what the paper was at that time in 1927, about the housing hysteria of 1924, 25, 26, where housing prices were doubling and virtually doubling every year in several parts of the United States, particularly in Florida. There's this huge explosion of property values in Florida. That bubble burst in 27, mid-27, 1927, and it really started taking down housing prices in the major cities of the United States in 1928, and in many rural areas as well, where there'd been a lot of speculation in property, but particularly in Florida and out west. And by 1929, it was really picking up steam. And there are many scholars, many historians of the Great Depression who suggest that was what drove the crash on Wall Street, that the crash on Wall Street came about as a result of a liquidity crisis that was being driven by a housing crisis. And if so, then we are very much seeing history repeat itself. So that's my take on it, Eric, and that's the way I think it's going to play out. But I don't think that, you know, just because the federal budget, you know, runs from October 1st to September 31st, that on September 31st, everybody's going to shrug their shoulders and say, well, Uncle Sam's out of money. No, they'll just, you know, print some more, they'll appropriate some more. What we're going to see is the steady destruction of the dollar. And the fact that Volcker, you can tell how long I've been watching the Fed's chairman. The fact that Bernanke has not raised interest rates up into the 5 or 6% region, which is where, frankly, they should be if he wants to prevent inflation and stop the destruction of the dollar. And where, frankly, I think he's going to take them after the election, because this is a very political office, and Fed chairman, I mean, go all the way back to the 1970s, and you'll see consistently Fed chairman lower interest rates when Republicans are in office just before elections, and they raise interest rates when Democrats come into office or when Democrats are running for re-election. And they do it to punish Democrats and help Republicans. I mean, bankers and Republicans' interests are one and the same. And so I am submitting to you, for your consideration, the probability that Bernanke will raise interest rates right after the November elections. That whenever the next Fed meeting is after the November elections, you're going to see some substantial increases in interest rates in the United States, which is going to drive our economy even farther down. And if he does that, he may save the dollar and he may prevent gold from spiking, you know, over a $1,500 or $2,000 an ounce, or maybe even over $1,000. It may actually save the dollar, but it'll throw us into a recession that'll look like a depression. And that's the choice he's got. Which do you want? Do you want the U.S. economy or do you want the dollar to be strong? And my guess is that he's going to end up going for the dollar being strong, but he's not going to do it now because it would destroy George Bush and it would destroy John McCain's chance of becoming president. And that's the last thing that any Fed chairman wants. I mean, as the bottom line. Gloria in Long Beach, we have about a half a minute here, Gloria, before we've got to take a break at the bottom of the hour. I'm sorry. What's up?
Oh, I'm only waiting an hour, but you're worth it.
Well, that's sweet of you. Thank you.
All right. There's an expose on McCain. It is startling. And I'd like you and all your listeners to go to TruthDig, TRUTHDIG, one word, .com.
Mm-hmm.
And Elliot Cohn, a known writer, he's gotten a book on the destruction of America by this regime. Elliot Cohn, C-O-H-E-N. It's entitled McCain's Chilling Project for America. It's all about PNEC.
Right. Cain's connection with the Project for New American Century. Gloria, thank you for letting our listeners know about that. Yes, please check it out. It's a really important one. I agree. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress coming up next here on the Tom Hartman Program. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call us at 866-303-2270.
Don't worry
that breathing? This is just the NSA.
What are you doing?
Just lying here thinking about you.
I can hear you breathing.
That's not me.
35 minutes past the hour. That's the NSA. Welcome back. Yeah, George is listening to you, too. Or maybe it's Dick. I don't know. Christy Harvey is with us. She's the... She is the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, also does MikeCheckRadio.org, and Christy, welcome.
I wasn't expecting that part of the song. I just was sitting here cracking up. That's pretty funny. How are you?
I'm just great. Isn't that great? Speaking of great audio, there's two ads that are out right now, and I'd like to discuss them with you very briefly if I can. The first one is from MoveOn.org. This just came out. And it's a 30-second ad. You can see it over at MoveOn.org, their website. It's right up at the top. And here's the audio for it.
Senator McCain, you let me and my kids down. From the very beginning, I told him, this is a principled guy.
Now, this is the guy talking looks like kind of like a steelworker type of guy, mm-hmm. You know, real blue-collar, middle-aged.
So when you said you were going to help make driving affordable again, I believed you. And then your idea is to do offshore drilling, which I find out won't produce much oil for 10 years and then barely save us any money anyway? Okay, that's not a solution, Mr. McCain. That's a gimmick. We expected better.
MoveOn.org political action is responsible for the content of this ad.
So that's the MoveOn.org ad.
Right.
And, for some reason that page is giving me some noise. And then here's this from the Obama campaign.
He's practicing the politics of the past. John McCain. His attacks on Barack Obama, not true, false, baloney, the low road, baseless. John McCain. Same old politics, same failed policies. Barack Obama supports $1,000
in the class tax cut,
an energy plan that takes on oil companies.
I got to stop. For some reason, my computer just went nuts.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Here's what I wanted to discuss with you, Christy.
Uh-huh.
You and I both know that a lot of the ability of these kind of ads to work is to what extent they're picked up by the media. The
right.
fact of the matter is that McCain's original ad, which was attacking Obama with the whole, you know, he couldn't bring the cameras, so he didn't bring the soldiers.
Right.
That only ran, as I recall, in a very small number of markets and was only purchased. It was only a couple $100,000 ad buy. It was just, and their goal was to make sure that it got picked up by the media, which it did.
Right.
And so far more people saw it when it was played on Hardball than saw it, you know, ever on TV or radio. And the question is, will these Obama ads, and the Obama ad actually played on Hardball yesterday, but they cut off the bottom part of it visually, so people never got to see the actual details of, you know, the New York Times indicting John McCain and the Wall Street Journal indicting John McCain and all those things. I mean, I thought that was very bizarre in and of
mm-hmm.
itself. But to what extent do you think that there is an inbuilt media bias among the corporate media for John McCain that is causing his ads to get, I mean, his anti-Obama ads seem to me to get at least 3 days a news cycle, and that these ads probably won't get anything close to that.
No, I think that you're onto something there. You know, if you look at John McCain's most recent ad was the one that basically complained that Barack Obama was too popular, which I thought
right.
was a very strange ad. And, you know, that one, for some reason, it was like 2004 all over again, and it brought up Paris Hilton and Britney Spears. I love when these political types decide to get into pop culture. They're always about, you know, 4 years too late. And that one, you know, got a lot of play everywhere. But I have to admit that I have not yet seen either of the two ads that you've played. I'll go look them up now. And I think it's also because John McCain's ads have been – you know, there is a little bit of the inbred media bias of the corporate media. But I think also John McCain's ads have been just a little bit bizarre. They've been very strange or nasty in a way that I think these two ads are fairly even keel. So that might be there's no sensationalism there like there are with some of McCain's ads.
Yeah. And now we're learning that this, according to the a Republican campaign strategist who was interviewed by Business Week.
Mm-hmm.
This is a quote from Business Week. According to a GOP strategist I spoke with over the weekend, they had a script ready to go if Obama had visited the wounded troops, saying that Obama was using wounded troops as campaign props. So no matter which way Obama turned, McCain had an Obama bashing ad ready to launch.
Wow.
And then the author says, I guess that's political hardball, but another word for it is the one word that most politicians are loath to use, a lie.
Well, I think that's very interesting, especially, you know, you don't often get a look behind that curtain and see how they are making the political sausage there. And
it's amazing to see it in Business Week, you know,
absolutely.
A Republican being quoted in Business Week. And again, in the Wall Street Journal here, the Wall Street Journal has this question, you know, this columnist, David Henninger, says he looks at McCain's tax policy and he says, this isn't a flip-flop, it's a sex change operation. And,
right.
And, you know, and he's wondering, you know, is McCain, he asks him if he has the mental focus and the intellectual discipline to take on Obama.
And this is the Wall Street Journal. We're not
that's
talking
right.
about some liberal rag here, you know.
That's
I
right.
think that's very
this is
interesting.
Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal.
Right. And I think that that's just very telling. If you look at a lot of, you know, how the McCain campaign has been putting a lot of their energies into complaining about Barack Obama and a little less energy into coming up with viable political policies, which I think could hurt them in the end because, you know, everybody I think is really ready for a candidate or a president who doesn't seem to just be winging it all the time like we've been saddled with for the past, you know, seven and a half years.
Carl Wolfson is the morning host here on KPOJ in Portland, and he's one of the most astute political observers I've ever met. And he suggests that the McCain campaign has three two-word pieces to it, and that's
uh-huh.
it. There are three items, and every single ad you're going to see out of the McCain ad from now until November is essentially going to be one of these three things in some variation. It's always going to come back to this. Win Iraq, drill oil, lower taxes. And that if he can keep everything on message, that with a very, very simple, you know, just like Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. No matter
mm-hmm.
what question people ask Bill Clinton, you know, what do you think about birth control? Well, if people had better jobs, they could, you know, it always came back to the economy. And I have not been able to identify the three sound bites that Obama is running on.
Well, you know, I think that the progressive movement and the Democratic Party specifically has always been pretty bad with the whole bumper sticker thing. You know, before it was always, you know, God, guns and gays was the big Republican bumper sticker. And
right.
and I think Democrats and progressives also sometimes just they wander a little bit. They want to work on everything and it's hard to distill the message down. But I think with McCain, you got to keep it in one or two word sound bites because he's got to remember them.
Yeah.
And he hasn't really shown a lot
of. Oh, Christy, now.
I know.
Yeah. But you're right. I mean, he does tend to wonder. ExxonMobil just showed, if I have this correct,
uh-huh.
the largest quarterly corporate profit of any corporation in the history of planet Earth.
Yes, they've officially made more money than God. They came down with a $11.68 billion profit they announced today for this second quarter. And if you do the math, that works out to, in this past quarter, they made $1,500 every second.
And they're spending about 1% of their profit, not of their budget, not of their revenues, but of their profit on renewables, and they're apparently spending more than that on advertising the fact that they're looking at renewables.
That's what I think is interesting, because, you know, if you watch, especially on the Sunday morning shows, I don't know if you watch those as mm-hmm. frequently as I have to, but Exxon always has these big ad buys, and it's all about how they're working to find renewable resources, and they're working to, you know, have greener technologies, and it turns out that they spend more on that ad campaign than they actually do on what they say they're doing in those ads. I think
yeah.
that's interesting for some reason.
Yeah, well, you know, what can you say other than...
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
Yeah.
True.
You do not have immunity in this round. Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton, the former chief of staff and... or she was actually the White House counsel, he was the chief of staff. to George W. Bush. They have been claiming executive privilege. A federal judge says no.
Yes, and this is very interesting. This just happened this morning, and U.S. District Judge John Bates ruled that they do not have immunity from congressional subpoenas. If you remember, Congress subpoenaed both their emails and their notes, as well as their testimony about the hiring, the illegal hiring practices of the Justice Department with the whole Alberto Gonzalez.
But isn't the real meaning of this that, you know, Judge Bates has ruled on this, so now the Justice Department will take this, or the or whoever, you know, the White House, we'll take this to a federal appeals judge or court, you know, a three-judge court, and then they'll ask for the full seven judges or nine judges or whatever it is. And then if they don't get that, they'll take it to the Supreme. That there's no way that this is going to be resolved before the election.
Probably not, but it was still a step in the right direction, especially now when Karl Rove completely skipped his stiff to Congress, skipped his congressional testimony just a couple of weeks ago, and he's saying the exact same thing. So this gives him a little less of a leg to stand on, and hopefully we'll get some answers thanks to Judge Bates.
It would be nice. It would be really nice. Christy Harvey, always great talking with you, Christy.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
AmericanProgress.org. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Coming up next, the news of the day from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at HartmanRadio.com.
Once made sense, but now something's off. It's since your secret meetings in Dick Cheney's office. Oh, it's on. You just take it, you take it, keep taking.
Oh, Exxon, you had the greatest profit ever.
It's a scam. Oh, Exxon, it's so clear from the profits you're making.
They're huge.
That you don't give a damn. Oh, Exxon. Getting rich on the back of this nation. And double huge war, oh, Exxon. Keep on screwing the next generation. I say, screw you.
Yes, Exxon, our friendly and gentle message. We don't need those stinking oil monopolies. It's time to bring out the Sherman Antitrust Act. That's what it's time for. Ellen Radner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, their new, spiffy, highly improved, and incredibly functional website. Hey, Ellen.
Wow, wait till you see what we do during the conventions. It'll be a lot more improved than that.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
I guess the biggest, well, there's two big pieces of news today. One is that Congress actually won this court battle between the Bush administration and Congress and said that lawmakers can subpoena Bush administration officials and compel them to testify. This was U.S. District Judge John Bates. He said there's no legal support for President Bush's claim that White House Chief of Staff Bolton and former legal counsel Harriet Myers are immune from congressional subpoenas because of the mandated separation of powers.
We were just talking with Christy Harvey about this in the Center of American Progress. Do you know, as far as I can tell, this, you know, this is nice and it's a positive statement and a move in the right direction, but it's not something that's going to cause these people to show up before Congress because it can be appealed to a federal appeals court and then it can be appealed to the Supreme Court.
They can run out the clock. Yes.
Yeah. So this is not something that's going to lead to the testimony of these people. It just points out that the administration is playing games with us.
They are definitely playing games, and actually then Senator Leahy of the Judiciary Committee said that he called it the claims are part of the arrogant White House cover-up designed to shield the public from inappropriate and illegal actions of this administration.
Yeah, and absolutely true. So we won some talking points today, but, you know, the administration, in terms of keeping Karl Rove out of jail, or in this case Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton, the administration is still, 5-1 or whatever the score would be, how much farther we still have to go.
Then today, well, there were a couple other, Nancy Pelosi had a presser and, Senator
Schumer. Oh, that's interesting.
had a presser along with Markey and Rahm Emanuel from the House and Senate together on oil, talking about the record profit oil and how, in fact, that the CEO of Exxon, at least according to Schumer, makes more money than they have put into research and development.
Wow. Just the, you know, I knew that they were making, they were spending more on advertising the fact that they do green than they spend on doing green. But you're saying the R&D cost, which, they, by the way, they get a super deluxe tax break for R&D. The R&D expense is less than the expense of their CEO?
That's what they said for Exxon. And that, and that what they said that they're putting all their money in, billions of dollars, is to buying back stock that comes up to essentially inflate the price.
Hmm. Interesting. So that the stock, which is held as a form of compensation in the form of stock options by all of the senior executives, goes up dramatically, and when they cash it in, they pay capital gains rather than normal income, and they pay a maximum income tax of 15% on that money.
Right.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's a show game.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
Schumer was just adamant about it this morning.
Yeah.
I've never heard him, you know, he's not the most animated person that's ever walked across the planet.
So what did Nancy Pelosi have to say for herself today?
Well, Pelosi is concerned just about what they're doing in terms of trying to get in the way of legislation and the Republicans. And she said, you know, we've made tons of offers around votes, et cetera, and we're just not getting anywhere before we leave. So she was, she was pretty adamant about that. She said that she is aware also of the sort of blue dog concerns on energy and other issues, and that she is trying to work with them.
Did she address at all the issue of impeachment or holding these guys accountable for their crimes?
She didn't really go there, and I didn't think she would at this point.
Yeah.
Also, Senator Kerry delivered a speech today, and he said that the United States should engage in a strategic reorientation that was already enacted by Saudi. He said basically the Saudi government has been able to get an upper hand in the fight against terrorism by using counter-indoctrination. And what they've essentially do is got these imams to talk about Islam's opposition to extremist ideologies. In other words, they've really gone to the mosques directly to try and influence. And he said that we also must give not necessarily military aid, but aid to the Pakistani people so that they can not have to go to the Taliban to sort of rescue them when they're in need of
Yeah, I mean, this
services.
Is like when you and I were in southern Sudan on the Darfur border. If people are starving and they're hungry, they're going to go with whoever brings them food.
Right.
I mean, it's just so simple and so straightforward. It's this book, Three Cups of Tea, you know, about this guy. He built 25 schools with the cost of one cruise missile. And in those districts where he built the schools, they're throwing the Taliban out. And in those places where we're dropping cruise missiles on wedding parties, they're bringing the Taliban in. They're embracing them.
I mean, last but not least, the president says that progress in Iraq will lead probably to troop cuts this year.
Yeah, of course. I've been predicting for a year and a half now that he would declare victory and pull out just before the elections. Thank you, Ellen. Ellen Radner, TalkReadyNews.com. I'm on my way off to Madison, Wisconsin, NonstopRadio.com for information on that. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders and Anything Goes Friday. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow live from the mic, 92.1 WXXM in Madison.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.